Hello, and welcome to this first episode of a new season of the Pump Court Family Law Podcast. I'm delighted to be kicking it off today with two greats of the family law world. Firstly, George Mathewson, founder of Mathewson Consulting Limited and a leading expert on pensions, and of course, an expert member on the first iteration of the Pension Advisory Group, who authored the well-known PAG report. George's role now is as an ambassador for RBC Brewer & Dolphin, and he largely spends his time talking to family lawyers, speaking about all things relating to pensions on divorce. Very apt for this podcast. Secondly, I'm joined by our very own Edward Boydell. He is head of our family finance team at Pump Court and is ranked consistently as a star individual in the directories. George and Edward are going to be speaking to me today about the case in which they both appeared, known as CMX and EJX, French Marriage Contract, a 2022 case. Edward was instructed by Miles Preston for the wife, and it featured a pension report by George. Whilst it's a really interesting case on the issue of prenuptial agreements and top-up of maintenance, of which we might do another podcast soon, for obvious reasons today, we're focusing on Mr. Justice Moore's comments regarding pensions, which may or may not have reignited the debate on whether sharing means equality of income or equality of capital. So George and Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Morning, Tara. Good morning.
Good morning. Without further ado, Edward, can I come to you and ask you about the factual issues in the case?
Yes. So this case's primary issue was really about the French marriage contract. This is a couple who married in their 20s, around 30 years ago now. And shortly before they married, they went, of course, in France, it's both a civil ceremony and a religious ceremony. They went to see the notaire, and they both signed up to what's called a séparation de biens, one of the forms of French marriage contract.
Yeah.
Under the séparation de biens, the parties keep their assets separately. That's both the assets that they bring into a marriage and those that are acquired during the marriage. And of course, the principal issue for the wife was her case, which is that she did not appreciate the extent of signing up to the séparation de biens. It had been her view that or understanding that this would keep their assets required from their respective families away from any dispute. They both came from pretty well-to-do French backgrounds, and family property has been handed down to both of them, both around the time they got married and subsequently. They've both received money, and in fact, four of their parents are still alive, so more money will be in the pipeline. What, my client was seeking was the judge not to uphold it in relation to the assets that they created by their own endeavours during the marriage. Now, she wasn't successful in that. I have to say, I didn't think that was a great surprise, because Mr. Justice Moore had already dealt with a relatively similar case called Z&Z some time ago.
Yeah.
Court of Appeal have pronounced in Versteg and Versteg much more recently. And there is a strong policy decision to uphold French and European marriage contracts, particularly if they're part of the culture of the couple that they marry. So that bit wasn't surprising. However, it was important, we felt, to run it anyway. Firstly, because you never quite know how the evidence is going to come out as to their understanding. And in fact, the husband was fairly straightforward that he didn't really understand the ramifications as they turned out, i.e. that they were going to live their married life in the UK and that he was going to make 25, 26 million pounds. But he was resolute that it meant, or that they both understood that if there was a divorce, that's how the assets would be divided. So that was the primary issue. And I think it's important to remember, both in relation to the pension issue, which has really arisen as a result of only, of course, two paragraphs in quite a long judgment, and the top-up maintenance issue, that they have to be seen against the background that this is quite a fact-specific case in many ways. Yeah. And the primary issue was obviously the marriage contract. And so when you come to think about the pensions, Ms. Justice Moore will have had in his mind throughout, probably quite firmly, which way he was likely to go. Hmm. And if it had been an all-out sharing case, it might be that he would have taken a different view for reasons I'll come to. But he probably suspected in this case that it was going to be a needs-based case, in which case a pension report would have been far less crucial to him, because all he was doing was working out how much the wife needed moving forward. And of course, actually, the perhaps the best part of the case is that we managed to get her $9.5 million to meet needs. So we're now away from the Rademacher-Granatino idea of the provision of either basic needs or to alleviate the predicament of real need when you're provided with at least two holiday homes.
Oh, well, that's what I was going to say. Wasn't it a main home and, from memory, two holiday homes, including a ski chalet or flat?
Well, in some ways it's three, because they already had a small chalet which she'd put into a French company name.
Right.
So she retains access and the principal of that small French company, even though the shares are held by the children, to the ski chalet, but she's entitled to buy another chalet in Mirabel and another holiday home in France, and of course a principal home in London. So her needs are being pretty well met.
Yes.
I think probably in time that'll be seen to be the key issue.
The high, yeah.
So I suspect he already was taking a bit of a view when he dealt with pensions.
Yes.
In terms, of course, of pensions, the directions, that starts before Moore was ever involved. Mm. Because during the pandemic, we ended up remotely dealing with a deputy district judge in Willesden.
Right.
In the very first, the first appointment that we had, Stuart Leach, now KC, and I tried to agree as many directions as we could. We knew the case was going off to the High Court. And as is standard now, you tend to agree pension reports because you anticipate that the judge is going to order them anyway. And you go and have your first directions in front of the High Court judge, and that is already underway. And so that was all agreed in front of the judge at Willesden. And we agreed standard terms, probably more standard then than now, that we'd be looking at income equality at various different ages. We then go in front of Mr. Justice Moore on the first hearing in front of him, again, still remote, because we're still in pandemic times. And that's when he decides that he would never have ordered such a pension report. And he's really railing first against the number of different ages that income equality is being looked at. That seems to be his primary concern.
Because I think you'd said 60, 65 and 67 initially, hadn't you?
Yes. And he and other judges are very concerned, as I know George is actually, and George, I'm sure, will deal with this, which is the quite undirected instructions which sometimes come, where masses of calculations are sought, and sometimes there's an argument about pre-acquired pensions, and so you have to then calculate each one of those dates with equality, and then against using two periods of contribution, and it becomes a whole unwieldy. So his principal concern was about that element, although he starts making comments that he would never have ordered a report at all, because he says, with 26 million, why do I need a report? Even if it's an equality case, I'll just divide them down the middle. Mm. He doesn't actually remove the direction for the report, even though there's been a delay. And perhaps one of the most important things also to take account of is that there was going to be a very significant lifetime allowance issue in this case. They were all 3 million broadly. My client had some pension funds, but the husband had many times more than her. And any order was likely to be of advantage to them because it was going to reduce the lifetime allowance burden on the husband. And you could at the least take my client's share up to the lifetime allowance, even if you didn't go beyond it. In fact, of course, now they've both become richer, as perhaps happens in modern Britain, but lifetime allowance has meant that they're not going to be paying the lump sums for the tax burden on crystallization. So from that point of view, they'll probably both be happy with what the Chancellor's just done. Yeah. So importantly, we had a report to help with splitting it. And then, of course, George prepares his report. So that's the brief background of how we got to where we are.
Thank you. So George, over to you then. Preparing the report, what were the pension issues?
Well, first of all, Edward, thank you ever so much for saying that we weren't to blame for all of the delays. And in fact, there were other circumstances, because I know Mr. Justice Moore was concerned about some of the delays, shall we say. And, you know, they weren't all within our domain. So thank you for elaborating on that. And it's also important to note that I have a great deal of sympathy with what Mr. Justice Moore or judges in general say about the number of calculations that they are presented with. Three different retirement ages, 60, 65, 67. If you're then going to run an argument that the pensions accrued pre-marriage should be excluded, that doubles the number of calculations to six. If they can't agree when cohabitation starts, that's probably another three calculations. That's nine. Then in some cases, they want to exclude post-separation. That's 12, and then they can't agree on the separation date. So you see how it sort of becomes a gearing effect as to the number of calculations. And then, of course, when we get issues like lifetime allowance thrown in there, quite often we will say something like, well, if lifetime allowance is or was in those that case a real driver, then actually another retirement age you really ought to be considering is retirement as soon as possible, because the deferment of retirement to later ages, 60, 65 and 67, is only going to exacerbate the LTA issues. And so therefore, the expert introduces another retirement age because of the perceived driver of lifetime allowance.
So George, just pausing there, what's the most number of calculations you've ever had to give in a report?
128.
Oh, my goodness.
128 calculations. And we actually went back in that case to the instructing solicitors and said, I meant this most sincerely. I know using the phrase "with the greatest of respect" can be quite insulting, but it wasn't meant to be insulting. You're saying "with the greatest of respect, are you sure?" Because this wasn't a big money case. This is a case of total pension assets were about £150,000.
Oh my goodness!
And we said there's going to be 128 calculations here. The costs are going to be way out of proportion to the assets. Are you sure? And we got the most gloriously written letter back from one of the solicitors, and it was absolutely beautifully written. It was along the lines of, we are yet to get to the state where judicial proceedings are run by expert witnesses. I am quite sure that as soon as expert witnesses do become judges, you'll be the first to throw your hat in the ring. In the meantime, can you please restrict yourself to doing what you're instructed to do? Oh, and by the way, for each of those 128 calculations, can you do it an alternative way, assuming the husband takes maximum tax-free cash, which takes it then up to 256 calculations?
Oh, George, that's wonderful. You were telling us about the pension issues in this case.
So the issues in this case were largely that we were confronted with significant pensions, largely of defined benefit in nature. They were complex, made more complex by the lifetime allowance tax issues. We, of course, as the experts, we live in a cocoon. We only know what the pension assets are. We don't have the full context of the case. We no longer get to see the full form. We just get the extracts of pensions. We have no idea that there's total pension, the total assets in the case of 25 or 26 million pounds. We don't have that context. We, of course, can make some sort of assumptions that if there's 3 million pounds of pensions, there are going to be quite a few other assets kicking around the place. So we're working in a lacuna of context to the case. And yes, I think we have been involved in some cases where we have been instructed where there are pensions of 2 or 3 million pounds. They are all defined contribution in nature. And we can see, we have seen that case, that there's still 50 or 60 million pounds of non-pension assets. And on occasions, we actually have written back and to our instructed solicitors and said, are you sure that you actually want a pension support here? Because clearly this is a case where you can add them up and divide by two if they're defined contribution in nature. But we haven't got that context, this case. And so whilst I note what Mr. Justice Moore says about the instructions in such cases in paragraph 14, but I don't... I think he's shooting the messenger a little bit in having in sort of intimating that we shouldn't have taken the instruction on.
Right. Yes. Hadn't he already decided that he didn't think a quality of income was necessary, and but that was still within the report?
Yes, he had come to a conclusion. He said in a number of... he referred to the case of SJNRA, which was a decision of Nicholas Francis QC, as he was then sitting as a deputy in the High Court. And I loved Mr. Justice Francis' decision at SJNRA. I thought that was a superb decision. Sorry, who is it for me to congratulate a High Court judge on a decision when I'm not even a lawyer? But from a pensions point of view, I thought it was a great decision. Because in SJNRA, Mr. Justice Francis was confronted with pensions which were defined contribution in nature. It was not a needs case, it was a sharing case. And both parties were past retirement age. And therefore, they could access the entirety of their... Sorry, they could access their pension funds as cash.
Yes.
Albeit subject to a tax charge. And Mr. Justice Francis referred to the pension freedom rules, which for defined contribution funds allowed the parties to access the accounts as cash. And so he said, look, these can be treated as building society accounts, albeit they're subject to a tax charge. But in effect, you can access these pension funds as cash. There's no need to look at incomes. We can treat them as cash assets because the entirety can be accessed subject to a tax charge. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
The post-retirement age that it could access them. I thought that was a very reasonable decision. Mr. Justice Moore then cites this judgment of Nick Francis, and he says, I could not agree more with Mr. Justice Francis' decision. If assets are to be divided equally, they should be divided equally. In general, there is no justification for awarding more to one party because they're younger or have a longer life expectancy. And that's exactly what Mr. Justice Francis said in SJNRA. You know, we wouldn't divide a building society account based upon age or anything like that. So why should we divide the pensions when they can be treated as a building society account? But the facts in CMX and EJX were fundamentally different. We weren't dealing with defined contribution funds. We were dealing with defined benefit pensions, where there is a fairly readily accepted understanding that very, very often with defined benefit pension funds, the CEV does not represent the true value of that pension. The CEV often understates the true value of that pension. And the reason why, in many cases, calculations for equality of income they are seen to favour the wife, are seen to give the wife more than 50% of pension assets as valued by the CEV, is because if we are to equalise incomes, then because the CEV understates its true value, she needs to have more than 50% of that pension capital. And that was the reason why in the calculations, our calculations for equality of income suggested that the wife needed more than 50% of the CEVs. It was nothing to do with age. Indeed, Mr. Justice Moore says he became very troubled by directions that ask a pension actuary to calculate the division on the basis of equality of income in retirement. Apart from the fact that such reports tend to be very expensive, the simple fact is that such a direction almost enshrines the Duxbury paradox into practice. It cannot be right in general that the younger you are, the greater the award. In any event, it has no place whatsoever in equal division cases. Well, the point is, if the wife is younger, pre-retirement age, she doesn't get more. She actually gets, all other things being equal, she gets less. The reason that my calculations are saying that she needs more than 50% of CEVs was because the CEVs did not reflect the true value of the husband's pensions. The fact that the wife was younger actually suppressed the pension sharing order she would otherwise have had. So that gives me a little concern that the principle, clearly I didn't make that point firmly enough or clear enough in my report. But the reason that it was more than 50% was not because of the age difference. It was, in fact, that worked in the opposite direction.
Mm.
But of course, what I don't know, and I'm very keen if Edward can give me his view on this. Mr. Justice Moore, in the judgment, in paragraph 14, prefaced it with, in a case such as this, when in a case where there are assets of £26 million, whatever it is, he cannot conceive of a more inappropriate direction to have a pensions report. But then 40-odd or 30-odd paragraphs elapse before he returns to the pension issues at paragraphs 49 and 50. Do we think that that preface in paragraph 14, which is not then repeated before Mr. Justice Moore comments on the pensions, do you think that preface should still be applying to the pensions at paragraphs 49 and 50? Or do we think Mr. Justice Moore is saying in all cases he cannot think of a more inappropriate approach to pensions?
So, George, that's quite a tricky question to answer, because I'm not sure. In fact, I'd probably be sure that Mr. Justice Moore hadn't quite connected the particular complications of these pensions when he makes those early remarks. I think what he and judges are keen to get over is that pension reports should really be directed to the necessary issues in specific cases, having really thought about what's going to be important. And as you were saying about the, you know, the 128 calculations and then doubled, there seems to be a blanket approach from solicitors and from counsel as well, probably because we want to be protective of each other and particularly the client, that we're just going to have a kind of standard report rather than actually fleshing out what's going to be of great importance. And so I think that's his general cry in 14. Further on, I think that he falls into the error that you say, and I use those words with the greatest respect, because if this was a sharing case, it would have been very unfair on my client not to have taken on board the report to try and have divided the pensions equally, particularly as there is obviously a strong desire from judges to make sure that you have equality of division of liquid assets, and then you turn to pension assets. And I still think that you're, of course, absolutely correct in your message that far too many people are rather pension blind. They see CEVs, they think that means the same thing, whether they're defined contribution, defined benefit, whatever the lifetime allowance issues might be. And they don't really want to spend time going behind those figures. It's just convenient. In many ways, the creation of the CEV has created a convenient figure, but unfortunately, it's a mirage. And I still think we struggle to get that over. So I think his primary concern, this is why these cases are very fact-specific, was the marriage contract. And I think a lot of his comments about pensions would have been different if the primary issue of this case had been pensions, because we didn't spend very much time talking about pensions. There was very little in my note about pensions. These were comments that were largely made not following detailed submissions from counsel.
But Ed, isn't it? I mean, one could say it's even more important in a needs rather than a sharing case to actually have the pensions report firstly valuing the pension CEV accurately, and then particularly in defined benefits schemes, then being able to advise what that actually yields in terms of an income.
Yes, it's crucial. It's crucial perhaps unless you're going to leave a wife with 9.5 million in any event, in which case you can be a bit more broad brush about whether she can meet her needs.
Fine. So context is everything, really.
Context is everything. And the other thing which I'm very keen to hear George's view upon, and actually I hope PAG will deal with one day, is that there seems to be becoming an increasing habit of high court judges, because mostly it doesn't filter down to lower levels, to add in pension funds into calculations for what are effectively Duxbury overall, pound for pound. And this has some judicial support in a case from Mr. Justice Mostyn, one of the JL and SL cases, I think it's JL and SL number 2, where in his calculations, but without much explanation, he adds in the divided pension as though the pension is going to be pound for pound in the hands of the wife. And that seems to me to create an issue if, as you say, if you're concerned about what it's going to yield, I think you do need to know from a pension expert. And the other issue, which was, I think, important in CMX and EJX for us to know, was what is our client going to have to pay by tax penalties when her overall pension funds exceed the lifetime allowance? And under his order, they were exceeding the lifetime allowance by £200,000 to £300,000 by the time she got the divided pension and had her original pensions, and would have exposed her to a lump sum, which she has no control over mitigating. Whereas the primary beneficiary, the husband in this case, has various different tools at their disposal to try and mitigate tax loss, because George will explain much better than me, but you can mitigate the tax loss by drawing down before pension sharing orders, by crystallizing in a different way, by taking options to try and acquire a lifetime allowance. But you can't do that if you're the recipient. Now, obviously, we don't have that problem now, but we did then. And I think it was important to have detailed information so you knew exactly what the award was going to be.
So, George, I don't know if you're able to tell us this, but what's the profession making of this?
Most of my fellow professionals in this arena are experts who all sat on PAG 1. They clearly must be very masochistic, because most of them are sitting on PAG 2 as well, whereas I felt I'd served my sentence on PAG 1. But on PAG 1, we split into two groups largely, and we had one committee which dealt with evaluations and all things techie regarding pensions, which was really a thrilling part of the group, which is what I sat on. But then we had the legal side as well. And quite rightly, there was very little input on the legal side from the pension techie guys, from the actuaries, etc. That was dealt with by the professional lawyers, which included judiciary, included barristers, included solicitors and academics. And it was the legal side of the PAG that came up with the comments that largely it is equality of income is the way forwards. And we, I think, therefore would find that most of the people who sat on PAG 1, whether they be experts, pension experts or lawyers, were a bit surprised or raised an eyebrow at this judgment by Mr. Justice Moore. Because this seems to rail against what had become relatively accepted wisdom in as to how pensions were to be dealt with. But again, I emphasise again, we do have the preface at paragraph 14 in a case such as this, where there are assets of 26 million. So we're not clear as to whether, in our opinion, this is a judgment by Mr. Justice Moore, which he thinks should be applied in all cases. But if it is, then I think that certainly raises some eyebrows with the experts. The problem is Mr. Justice Moore talks about enshrining the Duxbury paradox into practice, which is the younger you are, the larger the award. If we run roughshod over equality of income, and we say it's equality of capital, and capital is defined by the CEVs, then what we are actually going to enshrine into practice then is that if you simply divide the CEVs by 50 by 2, and we're dealing with defined benefit pensions in the private sector, we are going to enshrine into practice a disadvantage predominantly to wife, the recipient of those pension sharing orders, because she is not going to get equality of income. Now, again, I feel very guilty talking about legal matters. I'm not a lawyer. But we look at the judgments in cases like Maskell, Caron, Martin Dye. They all refer to pensions as being future whole-of-life income streams. And if they are to be treated as future whole-of-life income streams, then surely it's the income that is equalised, not the capital values. So I think, it's a very long answer to your question. I think there's a few raised eyebrows on pensions experts here.
Perhaps then distinguishing a particular case from the general view as expressed in PAG would have made it a lot clearer going forward as to how we should be looking into, you know, sharing, for example, in bigger money cases? You know, is it appropriate when they're all defined contributions and we're talking about big money, and distinguishing it from the firm advice we've got from PAG, that we should really be looking at equality of income in these longer marriages?
You make a very valid point there, because in PAG, we sought on PAG 1 to identify situations where a POD report is not required. And one of the cases, or one of the scenarios we cited, was where all pension funds are defined contribution in nature. And indeed, that was the situation in SJ and RAO, the decision on Nicholas Francis back in 2014, all were defined contribution in nature. And had all pension funds been defined contribution in nature, I've got a lot of sympathy with add them up and divide by two, as long as there are no guaranteed annuity rates. And if people want to consider what the implications of missing guaranteed annuity rates when you've got defined contribution funds, look at the judgment of His Honour Judge Edward Hess in YC and ZC, which gives you the perils of missing guaranteed annuity rates. But on the whole, had they all been defined contribution in nature, add them up and divide by two is not a bad solution.
I think that, you know, as I said very at the outset, all these cases are very fact specific. And, you know, Mr. Justice Moore is the last person who would have wished to create a fuss in this area. And heaven help where we get any judge, perhaps particularly High Court judges, because of the importance of their judgments, who feel cowed by going into an area and shining a light on them because it's the right thing to do in their case. And I think at the heart of that's what Mr. Justice Moore was doing, because it was the just approach in this case. And I'm sure that if we hadn't had a pension report, we would probably have got, we would have got the same result in this case. And it doesn't cause great mischief in this case, the fact that we went down that route. It might have done had the overall approach been different, and particularly if they'd only had 5 million rather than 26 million, then it might have been greatly different, I think.
Edward, you make, again, another very valid point raised by PAG 1 here, that it's all to do with context and proportionality. Yeah. If you have assets, pension assets of 3 million in a case where total assets are 5 million, yes, of course, it's vital that we get the pensions dealt with correctly. If you're dealing with pension assets of 3 million in a case where total assets are 25 million, then I have a large degree of sympathy that, if we've got the pension solution out by plus or minus even 20% in a case where total, we're out by plus or minus £600,000 in a case of pension assets of 3 million, in a case where there's 25 million of assets, it actually isn't going to make that much of a difference. It's all to do with the context and the proportionality and how big are pensions in the context of this case. And that is what I think needed the clarification in that judgment, that it is said in paragraph 14 in a case such as this, but that is not repeated at a later date.
Mm. Well, I'll just finish off by perhaps asking Edward, what advice should we therefore be giving our clients in sharing cases following this case?
Well, I wonder, interested to hear whether what George thinks about this. I wonder whether the only lesson to learn from this case really is about thinking about the direction of a pension report if you need one very carefully, almost constructing some type of flow chart where you ask yourself, you know, first question is, you know, how much are the pension benefits overall? Because if the pension benefits are less than a certain figure, then you probably would be not interested in a pension sharing order at all. The second question is, you know, what type of pensions are we dealing with? Because if we're dealing with defined contribution schemes, you may decide you don't want a pension order at all. If it's a mix, you may well want one. If there are guaranteed annuity rates, you need to think about that. And so we could have a flow chart by which you go down and ask yourself these questions. And then first question is, well, do we need a POD report at all? And then the second question, what do we direct it to? And one of the things that I've always thought was curious, and it's a sort of device that I certainly use at times, is not to get terribly involved in the original joint instruction, but just to ask a question afterwards. If you think the judge is going to balk at you asking for an order directed that a pension sharing expert looks at a certain issue, such as cohabitation, start with a report which doesn't include that. See what comes out. Go back, your unfettered right to go back and say, thank you very much. Can you please now tell me what the answer would be if we only use this part of it? Might be an easier, more sensible way, and you might not need to do that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder whether what comes out of it, actually, the main message is, we obviously still need reports. We're still going to be guided very much by PAG, but perhaps we should all just consider very carefully whether we need a report and what it should be directed to, so that we're going to judges and having them more focused than we have in the past.
I think that flowchart is an excellent idea, Edward. And whilst I'm not sitting on PAG 2, I obviously know very well my colleague, Jonathan Galbraith, who's taken over from me at Matheson Consulting, is on PAG 2. So is Rhys Taylor. I'm seeing Rhys next week. I think I'll pass those comments on to him to take to PAG 2. They have come up these six scenarios where you don't need a PAG report. Yep. But if you're saying that needs elaborating on or taking it further, even if you do need a report, let's first of all settle, do you need a report or not? Those six scenarios are covered. If you do need a report, is there then some sort of flow chart which eases the way through to avoid those 256 calculations? And yep. In one particular case I was aware of, where the lawyers had run up costs of £18,000 in simply agreeing a letter of instruction to the PAG.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I shudder to think.
Well, on that note, I think we better call time. George, Edward, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara, for inviting me. And thank you, Edward. It's been great discussing this case with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, George, for all your time and your great wisdom. Thank you.